This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, back when I was growing up, I don't think I knew a single person with a peanut allergy. At least not one that I can remember. Did you, Anthony?
To be honest, I don't remember one either. And it's quite a contrast when I think about my daughter's school, for example, where there are lots of awareness about allergies all over the place, it seems like.
Exactly. And in fact, my daughter recently started daycare, and right there on the front door before we even enter the daycare is this sign that says nut-free zone, which is a sign that's a very common sight in, I'd hazard to say, most schools in the Commonwealth right now. And when it comes to allergies, there's been a dramatic surge, not just even around food. We're seeing similar patterns in other immune-related disorders.
And in some countries, the number of people suffering from type 1 diabetes and autoimmune disease has grown so rapidly. Some experts consider it an epidemic. Asthma and hay fever have doubled, even tripled, since the 1950s. The incidence of inflammatory bowel disease has grown even more than that.
So the question is, what is going on? Science journalist Moises Velasquez-Manoff spent several years investigating the question, and he's uncovered a growing body of scientific evidence that says, yes, the culprit may be in our environment, but not what we've added to it. Rather, the problem could be what we have taken away. His new book is An Epidemic of Absence, a new way of understanding allergies and autoimmune diseases. Moises Velasquez-Manoff joins us today from New York. Moises, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So first of all, let me ask you, you've written this very well-researched book about essentially one theory as to why there are so many autoimmune and immune-related disorders. Just about everyone knows someone who has one now. But this is also a story that touches close to home for you. You've got some immune-related disorders, don't you?
That's right. As long as I can remember, I've had asthma and food allergies. In fact, I was kind of on the vanguard of that nut allergy phenomenon that you just mentioned, in that I've been allergic my whole life to peanuts and sesame. And you know, back when I was a kid, nobody else had it. And now, as you just alluded to, it seems like everyone had it. In fact, about maybe between 1% and 2% of American children now have just nut allergies. And in terms of all food allergies, it's either between 4% and 8%. I mean, the most recent studies put it at 8%. So I was very interested.
Yeah, and in fact, you even opened the book, you talk a little bit about that, but you also talk about an even rarer immune disorder that you came down with when you were 11.
Yes, that's correct. Alopecia areata, which is basically your immune system turning upon your hair follicles such that it starts as a little bald spot, in my case on the back of my head. New bald spots began showing up, and then at some point, probably around age 15 or 16, I was completely hairless. No eyebrows, no eyelashes, and that's called alopecia universalis.
And when you were
universal deal.
When you were first diagnosed with that, were your doctors able to tell you definitively why?
Not at all. And in fact, they still probably can't. Basically, it was stress was the one theory. You know, you got stressed out, which kind of made sense. But there's also this, in my case, my parents went through a divorce and that sort of thing, starting a new junior high school. And then there's this association with allergic disorders in general, sort of this idea that the immune system is malfunctioning. There's a root malfunction. And makes you more prone to both allergic disorders and this disorder, which is of the hair follicles or in the skin.
If only the answer were so simple as stress. Stress was making my hair go gray, but I can't imagine that being the root cause for an 11-year-old, as that's how old you were when you were diagnosed with the alopecia. But in your book, you have this remarkable chart pulled from the New England Journal of Medicine, a 2002 study, that shows that from 1950 to the year 2000, the incidence of immune disorders or immune-related disorders such as multiple sclerosis, Crohn's disease, type 1 diabetes, and asthma have basically, you know, increased 2 to 3, even more fold in the past two generations. So, you know, in the biggest terms possible, what have you uncovered in your book as to why we might be seeing this surge of immune-related disorders in the United States?
And across the developed world, really. The simple answer to that is that we're too clean, but it's not that we take too many showers necessarily. It's that we co-evolved with certain organisms, and they've been around us so long, since the Paleolithic, which ended about 10,000 years ago, that our immune system actually depends on their presence in the sense that it expects the stimulus from, it could be certain parasites, it's a whole range of microbes, and that we actually are in this kind of symbiotic relationship with these organisms, and they've basically disappeared from the current environment.
Now, what is it that we know that so we're talking about bacteria, we're talking about parasites, worms. What is it that they were doing in our guts, if I might say, that was producing this sort of regulatory effect on our immune systems?
Right. Well, there's a range of organisms. So on one side, you have the sort of parasitic organisms that they take something from you. But because all mammals and all animals probably evolved with parasites constantly present, you sort of include them in your calculus of what to expect when you come out in the world. So they basically induce, because they take up long-term residence in your body, they engage the circuits within you that are anti-inflammatory, essentially. And then the fact that they strengthen those circuits ends up preventing the emergence of these other, what are inflammatory diseases. Mm-hmm. Now, those are the parasites. I mean, we're also in very close relationship with, you know, a whole, about 2 to 3 pounds worth of microbes in our gut. And they may be just purely mutualist, meaning that they're not, they don't really, the relationship is beneficial to both parties. They're not hurting you in any way or taking anything from you.
I love how you write in the book that basically, you know, if you took a different perspective of what a human body is, it's just this gigantic machine or substrate for microorganisms.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, that's not my metaphor. It just looks more and more like that. I mean, you're every day you eat, and then out the other end come your stool is something like half, you know, half in terms of weight. It's half living bacteria. So you procreate maybe once or twice in your lifetime, but every day you're giving birth essentially to these microbes and sending them out into the world. So it starts to look like, when you just pay attention to the microbes in the gut and to the microbes on our body, and you feed them and you give them a nice warm place to live and you, in some sense, protect them from incursion maybe, it looks like that you're just a spaceship for microbes.
You know, Moises, as I was reading your book, it occurred to me that, you know, first of all, I was going to ask you, okay, is it as simple as put down the hand sanitizer and step away from it? But it's much more complicated than that, because you show evidence that, you know, there's a pretty strong correlation when you say that, quote unquote, we're too clean between, for example, things like GDP and the relative incidence of these immune disorders. You have a wonderful example of what happened when, you know, between East and West Germany before the wall came down.
Yes, that's a terrific sort of historical find. And it actually applies to the entire Eastern Bloc. When the wall came down beginning in 1989, when the Soviet bloc began dissolving, all those countries had remarkably low prevalence of allergies compared to the westernized countries. And they never quite figured it out, honestly. I talk about two sorts of avenues of inquiry, and one sort of traced it to daycare, which you also mentioned, but which in study after study seems to protect children. If they go early to daycare, early in life, in the first year, the first 2 years, their chances of developing allergy and asthma are diminished later in life. And it's probably because of the sharing of fecal and salivary bacteria. And so that you get a nice, robust ecosystem going very early in life.
Sorry, yeah, Moises. Go ahead.
And so the other theory is that, for example, this comes from research on Estonia, is that in the food production, you know, you have vegetables and plants that are grown locally. They're not necessarily subject to the prolongation of shelf life that most modern foods are, that they retain their natural microbiota, and that sort of provides this constant wind and pressure of microbes that's passing through our gut that's actually good for us because we expect it.
I'm speaking with Moises Velasquez-Manoff. He's author of the new book, The Epidemic of Absence, A New Way of Understanding Allergies and Autoimmune Diseases, and this idea that there's a hygiene hypothesis out there that says it's a lack of parasites and bacteria and worms in our environment, in our human environments, that may be causing an increase in all manner of immune disorders and allergies. So listeners, what do you make of it? Do you agree with Moises Velasquez-Manoff when he says, hey, maybe we're just a little too clean? Are you willing to step away from that hand sanitizer and that antibacterial everything? And do you have relatives, say, who live on a farm or maybe in less developed countries, and do they seem healthier to you? Or does this theory just seem too simple and too good to be true? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on the web at radioboston.org. Now, Moises, I want to talk to you about this a little bit more in a second, because you did actually take the natural sort of inquisitive next step and try to recolonize yourself with a certain type of worm. But you did a ton of research, and who are some of the scientists that are really sort of pushing the envelope on this hygiene hypothesis theory whose work you found most compelling?
Well, the remarkable aspect of this is that at this point, I would say there are probably hundreds of scientists working on different angles of this story around the world. But in terms of people who pioneered it, Joel Weinstock is one. He came up with this treatment for inflammatory bowel disease that uses a whipworm that's native to the pig. And the idea is that it doesn't propagate in humans. And it's medically produced now by a company called Ovamed in Germany. And it's there's a company called Coronado Biosciences, which is trying to get, you know, they have to do trials, human trials, and prove safety and so on and efficacy. But they're looking for FDA approval, which means that some point soon, you know, we could have our insurance companies covering this for us.
Well, we actually do have Dr. Weinstock on the line. Dr. Joel Weinstock, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to participate. And I would like to congratulate Moises on producing a wonderfully written book on a very important topic.
Well, I should say that Dr. Weinstock is the chief of the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at Tufts Medical Center. And Dr. Weinstock, as Moises was just telling us, I mean, you've been doing this research for quite some time, to the point where one drug developed through your investigations is waiting for FDA approval. But take us back to what he was saying earlier, that there's this underlying theory that we've just sort of eradicated our environment too much of these essential worms and bacteria. What evidence have you seen that this is true, that it actually is correlated to the increase in autoimmune disorders that we're seeing?
Well, first of all, associations or inverse associations do not necessarily prove cause and effect. There's no doubt that many of these immunological diseases evolved in the early part of the 20th century and have been skyrocketing. It is very clear that the loss of intestinal parasites and changes in our intestinal flora are undergoing throughout the 20th century, and the inverse association between loss of bacteria, loss of certain organisms, and the rise of these diseases seems to be so. The interesting thing that makes it plausible that this is a cause and effect relationship is that these organisms, particularly the helminths, induce aspects of our immune system that regulate how we respond to things.
And helminths are parasitic worms.
Helminths are one form of a worm-like parasite that can live in the gut, and there's some that can live elsewhere. So the effects it has on our immune systems are very prominent, and people who lose these worms lose some of these regulatory pathways. This is already recognized. And the agents that are now being tested in the clinic are based on reawakening these sleeping circuits. And they're now in advanced stage of testing, both in Europe and the U.S.
Dr. Weinstock, if I might just interject here for a second, and forgive me if this sounds like a naive question, but you know, we're talking about co-evolution here between these parasites and bacteria and human beings. coevolution sounds like quite a long time, and yet the elimination of these things from our human environment really has largely happened in the past half century, 75 years, or 100 years, let's say, which is a blink of the eye in evolutionary terms. So it seems like, wouldn't we have required a longer period of time to see the effect of their absence?
No, it's just the opposite. You've had hundreds of 100 million years of evolution, 300,000 years of human evolution, where you're in close contact with something, and your immune system alters, the organism alters, until finally you reach a fine balance. Mm. Then suddenly, for the first time in history, in one or two generations, you totally withdraw from these relationships. The immune system doesn't know what to do. It's not prepared. We have not evolved to live without them. If we sterilized our intestinal tract, 50% of the dry weight of our stool is living organisms. If we sterilized our intestinal tract, we would die. We're interdependent colonies of organisms. We're not individuals.
We've got a lot of callers who want to join us, so I'd like to welcome them in. Rob is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Rob.
Hi. Well, I have an adopted daughter who was adopted from Guatemala at 4 months old, and she was in a foster home. So she never got mother's milk or anything. But she did go to daycare very early, and she doesn't get sick. Hmm. I mean, I think she might have missed a day of school over 3 years or something. But she did get sick a lot when she first went to daycare. So to me, there's some sense, I have some sense that she has a strong immune system and that it was built by this, you know, going to school with all these other kids. And also, she's been to Mexico a number of times since when she was quite small. And, of course, the cleanliness standards are a little different there.
Rob, thank you so much for your call. Moises Velasquez-Manoff, do you hear Rob's story? He thinks that early exposure when his daughter was just a few months old in Guatemala may have something to do with it. Did you uncover research that shows that maybe early exposure today could have similar effects?
Well, yes, absolutely. You know, growing up in a rural part of the developing world is a fairly strong protection against allergic disorders and against some of these autoimmune disorders as well. But I do want to add that getting sick with the flu or with some of the other sort of these are viruses or maybe bacterial infections, the sort of things that the childhood diseases, they don't really help us. There's a difference between the organisms that help us and the ones that do. And a lot of the childhood, you know, the measles, the mumps, the rubellas, even the flu, the common cold viruses, they come originally from animals, and that's the distinction. So they've basically hopped over from animals very recently, I mean, the measles may be just 200, the modern strain may be just 200 years old. Mm-hmm. So they don't know the human immune system the way that some of these helminths, these parasitic worms know it, that have been with us for much longer periods of time. And they don't necessarily help us the way we want, because they don't engage that regulatory circuitry.
Well, I did promise listeners a little earlier that we would talk about your personal attempts at trying to re-inoculate yourself with some of these organisms. You went down to Tijuana. Tell us what happened.
Well, let me just preface this by saying that sort of underground movement has taken root. They've read all this research, and they've basically jumped ahead of where the science is. The science hasn't yet shown definitively that this works. It's very compelling, yes. But, you know, there's the trial showing, especially with the organism that's being used, the hookworm, Nicator americanus, doesn't show yet to be that it helps in any way.
So don't try this at home.
basically, yes. Nonetheless, they try to professionalize it. These guys have basically gone and acquired the parasite from populations in the developing world, in Central America in this case. And so at that point, I was just really, out of all the disorders I have, I was most eager to get rid of my food allergies. My asthma is controlled. It doesn't really bother me much anymore. I've lived without hair for a long time. I don't really care about that. I really just wanted to be able to travel to East Asia and not have to worry about, you know, not having sesame in my food, or going to Africa and not having some parts of Africa where peanuts and everything.
So you go down to Tijuana and you essentially find this black market for a certain kind of worm, right?
Well, you find it before you go to Tijuana. You meet your guy in the parking lot on the way to Tijuana, and he takes you. He's your donor. And it's pretty professionalized. You know, there's a bandage. It goes on your skin. You feel it going in. It's the famous hookworm itch. It kind of feels like a stinging nettle a little bit. And then you sort of ride out the symptoms for the next few weeks as they take this odyssey through your body, and they end up in your small intestine. I did see some benefits. I had major symptoms as well. And ultimately, you know, I got rid of my hay fever for about half the season. And there, I did have some like sort of peach fuzz regrowth, but nothing dramatic like what I had seen other people talk about in the underground environment, and nothing that was worth the cost of it, which was pretty severe malaise and headaches and gut pain and so on, things I won't describe in too much detail.
Well, if I can get Dr. Weinstock back in here. So that's Moises's individual odyssey into a not recommended underground worm trade. But Dr. Weinstock, where's your research stand right now in terms of taking this hypothesis, you know, into actual drug development, if indeed that's the direction that you want to head in for other diseases?
Yeah, there are two directions we're moving. One is hookworm is a potential human pathogen, and it's not undergoing rigorous testing. And I very strongly recommend the audience to avoid hookworm. At this time, it is not considered a treatment. The drug that is currently being tested is a very safe helminth that does not cause symptoms. It is undergoing double-blind studies monitored by the U.S. and European Food and Drug Administration, and this one has already passed early testing showing potential efficacy. Mm-hmm. So this one has a pretty good chance of making it. So remember, not all worms are the same, and they're not all necessarily safe to use. So people should not indiscriminately go out and expose themselves to things.
I just want to get one more call in here if I can. Bill is calling from Westford. You're on the air, Bill.
Hi. In a more primitive world where there are a lot less people and a lot less viruses, you could probably survive. Your immune system could probably handle it. But it seems to me that part of the problem is that there is so many pathogens that we're exposed to every day that our immune system's just not strong enough. Is that possible?
Bill, thank you so much for your call. And Dr. Weinstock, that sort of led me to the last question I had for you, and that is, I'm sure you've received some pushback from colleagues. I don't know, because this line of research seems to go against what medicine and public health have been trying to accomplish for several centuries, which is the eradication of disease-causing pathogens.
Well, it's not against public health. Public health has been very important to us. We used to get epidemics like the 1800s where 25% of the children would die. So clean water and clean food and modern-day sanitation has allowed most of us to live a better life. The problem is that there's thousands and thousands of organisms out there. Most of them were so well adapted to, they cause us no harm. There's only a handful of organisms that could make us sick, very few of them, and they're the ones that we have not yet adapted to. So in the process of eliminating exposures to bad things, we're also eliminating exposures to good things. Some of those things we're exposed to are probably important for our health, and that's the awakening of the 21st century, that we do want to eliminate exposures to cholera and to salmonella, but most other things could be harmless or good for us, and we should maintain those exposures.
Dr. Joel Weinstock is chief of the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Weinstock, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Moises Velasquez-Manoff, author of The Epidemic of Absence, A New Way of Understanding Allergies and Autoimmune Diseases. So I'll let my kid wrestle with my dog. That's what I gather from the end of your book, Moises. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, let us know what you think at radioboston.org. And coming up, replacement referees in the NFL. Our own Bill Littlefield has his take on all of that. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.